Hey there, it's After Six. Todd Feinberg here with Michael Leibowitz once again, our favorite Connecticut resident of the prison system. And Michael, nice to have you here again.
Thank you, Todd. Nice to be here.
We're going to talk about assisted suicide. It's a big topic in the country. It was a topic during this legislative season in the state of Connecticut, and that legislation didn't pass. Nevertheless, Mr. Leibowitz sees it as an opportunity, I guess, to talk about political philosophy, which is always a good thing. Hey there, Michael.
Okay, so I was listening to the morning show on your network with Pastor Will the other day, and he was interviewing somebody. I don't remember who he was interviewing, but they were discussing some victories that I guess conservatives got in this past legislative session. And one of the things they counted as a victory was that the assisted suicide bill failed to pass. Now, I don't know what's in the particular bill, so I don't want to defend that, but I do want to defend an individual's right to end his or her own life. Now, this goes back to our last discussion where we were discussing about individual rights and, you know, when is it appropriate to use force in human relationships. And I propose that if a person doesn't have a right over his own life, he has no rights at all. And it seems especially dangerous to me to make one person's right subject to another's faith, which is ultimately what the argument came down to the other day on the radio, is that faith-based people or people of faith got a victory because this bill was shot down.
Well, yeah, it's this happens a lot in American politics because of the influence that evangelicals and religious folks in general have. They've got a lot of presence in Republican policy, and that's made the Republican Party, I think, less the Libertarian Party that it would naturally be, and more into another big government party, which is ironic because, you know, they're contradictory notions. But when it comes to things like this, I think you're right that Republicans are being a big party organization, a big government organization, rather, instead of being the small government people they're meant to be.
Yeah, this is actually the type of issue that always puts me at odds with conservatives, with whom I have a lot in common otherwise. It's just I don't understand how on one hand you can advocate for small government and economic rights, but then on the other, presume to tell people what they can and can't do with their own bodies and lives.
Yeah, only if you have some alternate narrative that's confusing you, which is what Republicans have been doing in order to build their base. It's the nature, I guess, of having a political system in which there are two parties that are representing the whole spectrum of political beliefs, and that means they have to contort themselves in order to build coalitions of power.
You know, it's funny to me you mentioned two parties. There's a philosopher named Leonard Peikoff who made an observation, and I don't know if it's accurate or not, but it made sense to me. And he talked about conservatives and liberals, and he said that each are big government, each favor big government. And he said, however, they want the government to control the thing they care about most. And he said in the case of conservatives, they care more about religious issues and spiritual issues and moral issues, so that's what they want the government to control, whereas they don't really care about economic issues, so they allow that to go free. You can be free in, you know, in that regard. Whereas liberals don't really care about moral issues, so they allow people to be free when it comes to morality. What they do care about are economic issues, so that's the issue that they want to control. I thought that was a good point that he made. Like I said, I don't know if that, you know, it's that cut and dry, but I do think that there's probably some accuracy to the statement.
Yeah, I don't know how you can argue that Republicans don't care about economic issues, except to argue that because they're political parties and because they're in politics, they don't actually care about anything except power and how to grow their power and how to get, you know, how to keep what they have and get more of it. But it's certainly a good point that they're hypocritical in the way they construct their viewpoints, because they're trying to bring this broad swath of humanity inside their tent.
Yeah, I would actually like to share a personal story about this issue, maybe to bring more life to it, if that's okay.
Well, I don't know. It depends on how much life. We can only take so much of that, you know.
Well, it's actually my mother's story that I want to tell. Now, my mother was raised by a poor, divorced, alcoholic mother. My mother had a lifelong struggle with severe depression and drug addiction, including heroin addiction. In 1993, I believe, my mother was sexually assaulted by a man who was actually previously did a sentence for murder. He did an 11-year sentence for rape and murder and was let out. Then I was sentenced to 33 years in prison. While I was in prison, my mother got pregnant and had a miscarriage. She eventually got somewhat clean. She was off the drugs, the street drugs, but she was still on antidepressants and methadone for years, and she was doing relatively well. Then she got caught at the methadone clinic with antidepressants that she wasn't approved to have, and she got thrown off of the program. She tried to get a prescription for another heroin substitute called Suboxone, but she was denied, and she ultimately got back on heroin. Now, facing life of addiction and depression with her only son being in prison, my mother decided to commit suicide. Now, as sad as that was to me, I just don't know by what standard Pastor Will or anybody else would presume the right to tell my mother that she had to live a life that she no longer wanted to live. And I think the answer is, as we've already discussed, is faith. But, you know, throughout history, a lot of people have committed a lot of atrocities in the name of faith and continue to do so. And it just seems to me that in this day and age, we ought to be governed by reason and in rational.
All right. Well, let me give you a reasoned argument, not okay. necessarily one I believe, but one that others might throw at you. And okay. that would be that if somebody wants to commit suicide, that's because they're suffering some sort of mental problem or some harsh circumstances in their life that make them feel desperate. And being that desperate is inherently irrational. And the best thing to do is to be able to protect them from that moment, because most people, if you can get them past a moment of acute depression, will turn away from their thoughts of suicide. And we also happen to live in an era in which we've learned so much about mental health that we have all kinds of abilities that we didn't used to have to be able to bring people back to a more rational point of view.
Okay, two things that I would like to say in regards to that. One, in the case of my mother was suicidal my whole life. She told me on many occasions that the only reason she didn't commit suicide was because of me, and she didn't want to put me through that. So her case was not an impetuous, you know, I just want to end my life now type of thing. And it seems to me, in regard to people that are suffering mentally, that those are the kind of people that that's just another problem that they have that they may want to get rid of. Now, I'm not advocating suicide. I'm not, like, pro people should commit suicide. What I'm saying is that they have to have a right to. And the fact that it might be irrational is their business. I don't. If we're going to have a rights-based society, but then we say people only have the right to make decisions that we deem rational, then we don't have a free society at all. What we have is a society that's governed by elites who think that they can claim to know what's best for everybody else.
That's a great argument. We're talking to Michael Leibowitz. He's been in prison for 22 years. Tell people, just as a reminder, about the crime that caused you to be put away for so long, Michael.
Oh, I hate talking about this, but I will. Okay, when I was 21 years old, the main crime I'm in prison for, amongst many, is I was extremely jealous of my ex-girlfriend and her new boyfriend, and I arranged for some friends of mine to break into her house to beat up and stab her boyfriend. And they stabbed him, and they stabbed her accidentally, but nonetheless, it was still my fault. And for that, I received a 27-year sentence that was to run in addition to a 6-year sentence that I previously had from another court.
So this is a great discussion we're having, and the reason I asked you to update us is because it's so unusual to imagine even having this kind of conversation with somebody in your life circumstances, and the magnitude of your intelligence and your sophistication on this subject, I just think is particularly surprising for people when they understand the context of your life. So how old are you now?
I'm almost 43. I'm 42. I'll be 43 in August.
Wow, so you were a kid when you went to prison. You were just 21?
I was 21, yes.
You were a crazy guy.
Yes.
No, and you have 1 minute left.
All right, so
now I'm
so
a crazy guy with 1 minute left.
When we, that's a pretty short sentence. All right, Michael will reconnect with us, and we'll continue this conversation in a moment.
Okay.
Go ahead, Michael.
I'll be right back.
The caller has hung up.
All right, continuing with Michael Leibowitz, Todd Feinberg here after 6. I'm glad we got that little update on your life story, even though it's hard for you to tell, or maybe especially because it's hard for you to tell. And I wonder if you knew that you had any of the intellectual inclinations or potential that you demonstrate now when you were that age and committing crimes.
Well, all my life I've been told that I was relatively bright. Every report card I ever had always came home and said, Michael continues to not imply himself, he should be doing much better. So I was always told that, and you know, sometimes I felt it, but for the most of the time I really didn't feel very good about myself. I wasn't confident in my ability, and quite frankly, I just wanted to be a criminal. I mean, to be honest about it.
That was your dream, huh?
Yeah, I mean, if you ever saw the movie Goodfellas, and when he's a little kid, Henry Hill says, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to grow up to be a gangster, and that's kind of the way that I felt, too.
Wow, it's so remarkable. So I like your argument on this right to suicide, and I feel the same thing on a human level. I have had moments where I wonder if that's the right conclusion to come to politically. And I think this is the other objection, is that government being such an insidious force, that it's dangerous to create governmental mechanisms through which decisions can be made to exercise your individual right to end your own life. So if you look at these programs that are popping up now for assisted suicide, it has to do with filling out applications, getting a panel or two or three separate doctors to sign off on the idea that you have a terminal illness. So there are all these protections built in. The purpose of having to certify that you're terminally ill and you only have a short time left is to avoid the hazards of people being able to create conspiracies to bump people off through mechanisms that would otherwise make it legal for them to commit suicide. So ironically, it seems to me we've got a libertarian argument bumping into a libertarian argument.
Yes, the great libertarian psychiatrist Thomas Sasz was very pro-suicide. He actually wrote a book called Fatal Freedom. He was also very opposed to physician-assisted suicide, I'd imagine for some of the reasons that you just stated. The problem for me is that, and this is kind of what I run into whenever I make libertarian arguments, is the whole system is so run and occupied by government that it always comes down to that, well, now the government's going to be involved. Well, maybe the answer there is to get government out of healthcare so that the decision is between the person and the person's doctor. And if the person's doctor doesn't want to do it for the person, that's his freedom, and he has a right to choose. But when you have the government as sort of this middleman deciding under what circumstances it's okay, to me that's no better than having the government telling me what I can and can't eat. They should just not be involved in that sort of thing at all.
And I think I mentioned to you last week that I've been having these thoughts about anarchy, about a system through which people make their own decisions and society creates its own decisions about how to proceed rather than turning power over to elected officials, because it doesn't matter how carefully you plan a system, it gets overrun with government interference like ours is now. Ours has become the thing that we fought a revolution to escape. And it makes me wonder if there's a way to avoid that. Like, how do you make rules like, okay, people should be allowed to kill themselves without worrying about government creating the infrastructure through which that is permitted, and then it's something insidious that can be manipulated?
Yeah, that's something they've been struggling with for a long, long time. I mean, Madison in The Federalist said something to the effect of, I don't want to say it's a quote because then I'll butcher it, but basically said if men were angels, no government would be necessary. And if angels were to govern men, we wouldn't have to put restrictions on government. And, you know, the great challenge is to create a government that's strong enough to uphold the rule of law, but not so strong as to override the rights of the people. And I don't know the answer. I think the answer might be that you have to have a populace that's devoted to liberty, that doesn't think that they have the right to tell other people what to do or to take other people's money or tell them how to run.
Yes, but whether you end up with that kind of leader or not is a fluke of history. If you are choosing leaders and turning that kind of power over to single individuals or small groups of them, then you're back in the same boat, and that is dealing with the seduction that power holds for the people who are in positions of power, and they see ways to expand it, so they misrepresent and manipulate to get more. So on this, how would you just change the laws so that suicide was legal and leave it at that, not have doctors or government involved with suicide?
Well, the thing is like we talked about before, okay, I think drugs should be legal, but they're not. So now you're in a situation where if a person wants to commit suicide and do it cleanly, where they're not ultimately infringing on somebody else's rights by, for instance, you know, blowing their brains out in a public square, or even in their house, where now somebody else has to come, you know, clean it up, they'd have to go to the doctor to get the prescription. But if all drugs were legal, then a person could simply go buy, you know, whatever amount of heroin they would need, overdose, and be done with it. But the way it is now, they'd have to go to their doctor to get, you know, prescribed opiates if the doctor so chose. So the answer is ultimately to get government out of our lives.
Right.
To restrict government, to restrict the right of the government to use force to only situations where it's self-defense or retaliatory, you know, force.
Yeah, so what you're saying is government is has so overstepped the boundaries of where it should be according to our founders and our system of government that there's a larger conversation that needs to be had. But what you're also saying is, and this is why I brought up the anarchy thing, is just that we need to be able to make all of these decisions on our own, and government should stay the heck out of our lives.
Yes, a good analogy I can make is in regard to school. Like, you have certain people think that the Pledge of Allegiance should be said in school and kids should be allowed to pray in school. Other people say that, no, that violates the Constitution because those, the government-run schools, essentially. Well, why is the government involved in schools? What in the United States Constitution gives the federal government the right to be involved in schools? Now, there's nothing that says local governments can't do it, but there's nothing that says the federal government can. But ultimately, if we had private schools, that wouldn't be an issue. You wouldn't have the issue of whether it's violating the First Amendment if kids are praying or saying the Pledge of Allegiance. It only becomes an issue because the government's involved. So that, you know, that's just another area that we need to get the government out of.
Yes, and to be fair, the federal government's influence over education is probably its weakest connection to the daily lives of Americans, but it is involved because it's trying desperately to take over something that it has no business being involved in. So it's got a Department of Education, which it shouldn't have, and that's part of the attempt of the government, the federal government and the Democrats, to connect politics on a national level to their whole union thing, which gives them so much power, and to be able to funnel federal tax dollars into education in order to keep unions happy. But even on a level where the federal government isn't the prime mover of education and education policy, it's still a problem having government involved with education. So I agree with you on all that. Michael Leibowitz, wrap up. Yeah. Give us a closing thought because we're running out of time.
My closing thing is I just want to say that it's interesting that our federal government is so involved in our lives that when you speak of government, federal government involved in education, where they pass No Child Left Behind, where Common Core is a, you know, a big push that they're trying to do, I don't know if they've actually passed it. But when government is that involved, when we've got this bureaucracy called the Department of Education, we can still say, yeah, but it's not as bad in education as it is in other areas. That really,
yeah, it's a good point, but it's really dramatically the case. So no, Common Core was done with a small pot of money, I think a few billion dollars that they used to bribe states to accept federal control over curriculum for, you know, like a couple $100 million each state or something like that. It was crazy. And it shows how insidious the federal government's role in American life can be. All right, Michael, good to talk with you. We'll talk again next week.
Thanks a lot, Todd. I look forward to it.
All right, that's Michael Leibowitz. Stay tuned. We got a lot of wonderful stuff coming your way. News is next, and then Clark Howard on WTIC. News Talk 1080.